I have a feeling coming on that I'm going to talk about a word which, on both sides of the Atlantic, has started to thunder as rhythmically as the guns at a royal salute. The word is corruption. However, the moment I start to concentrate on that word, the first thing that comes bubbling up from my unconscious is the memory of a very rousing mass protest meeting that took place in Central Park, New York, 3, maybe 4 years ago. If your memory can reach back so far to the protests of the early 70s, fashions in protest change with such speed these days, you may recall that the great new word was ecology. Well, there came a day which the young of New York, and by the instantaneous osmosis of television, the young also of London and Melbourne and Stockholm, a day they decided to dub Earth Day. Parades were organized to protest the pollution of old Mother Earth and to suggest, if only through chanted slogans, doing something about it. There was this vast march into Central Park of young people mostly, who, to their credit, felt strongly about defiling the earth and the heavens and the things that grow and breathe under the heavens. It was a large and it was a good-humoured crowd. They held a big picnic of root vegetables that had never known pesticides, of simple fruits, and they pledged their communion to the cause with what has become holy water to the pure in heart, namely yogurt. When it was over, they dispersed in orderly fashion, and it came out that it cost the Parks Department of the City of New York something like, I think it was between $15,000 and $20,000 to clean up the litter that they'd left. This may stand, I think, as a perennial warning to all idealists of the chronic gap that's likely to appear between preachment and performance. The same cautionary thought crossed my mind last week when I was cheered, as I'm sure we all were, by the immense scenes of jubilation in Lisbon at the overthrow of a 50-year-old iron dictatorship. And without prejudicing the revolutionary forces that will now have to find a new way to run Portugal, we can fairly say that tearing down is easier than building up, and that on every good protester there falls the necessary duty of having to replace a bad system with a workable good one. Or, at the very least, when we charge somebody with corruption, of pausing for a moment to wonder what we would have done in the same circumstances. What we've lately been seeing, both in America and Britain recently, is a wave of moral indignation against the corruption of public men by favors they may be tempted to do for private men with private interests. In a way, you could say it's a protest against the whole business of public relations when it acts as a method of making bribery socially acceptable. In both countries, there are bills pending, stricter than anything we've had before, to make men and women in public office, members of Congress, members of Parliament, publish all their outside sources of income. There's a rule, by the way, in the United States whereby presidents and vice presidents and justices of the Supreme Court, and in some states, governors, move the moment they assume office to put all their stocks and bonds, their investments, into escrow for the length of their term. But in both countries, we are going further and saying that the voters have a right to know when one of their elected representatives comes to vote on, for instance, a defense bill, an army expansion bill, to know whether or not he owns stock in a company that, say, manufactures army uniforms. We'll come to this at another time. For now, I'd like to talk about a particular twilight zone of morality through which all public men, by which I mean also well-known writers, football idols, movie stars, popular heroes, have to try and steer a decent course. I bring this up because it's always more convincing, I believe, to talk about something of which you've had personal experience, and it has to do with the whole art and practice of salesmanship, of persuading people to prefer your product or your contract to somebody else's. Salesmanship, which enlists millions of talented and persistent agents in every country, is obviously essential to industry, prosperity, to the very economy. I presume that even in the Soviet Union, the splendor of Russian products is not self-evident. I mean, even Mr. Brezhnev has to employ salesmen to invade the beastly capitalist countries to suggest that some things, dynamos, airplanes, automobiles, made in the Soviet Union are better than the similar things we make. So, of course, the trade of a salesman is an honorable one. It becomes shady only when a firm uses an influence, a talent, that lies outside its own skill to advertise that skill. The vulnerability of politicians is clear and has been made painfully so in both countries lately. But how about the famous actor or footballer who is prevailed on to say for a fat fee that your beer or razor blade is better than somebody else's beer or razor blade? This is surely just as much an attempt to deceive, to suggest excellence by association with somebody who is excellent in another field. A few months ago, a juicy offer came my way to do a 30-second commercial for an airline. I was assured by an eager public relations man that I wouldn't be seen, only my voice would carry the message. And I trust it's not coy to suggest that he wanted my voice only because it's a voice which, by dinning repetition over the years, is recognizable for itself. And maybe some of the things I've said with it have been persuasive, at least the PR man thought so. But I use my voice to vent my own ideas. They wanted to hire it to persuade me to express their ideas. Now, this is only a single example, and sometimes the offer seems so nice, so guileless. Maybe you really are a big fan of the product. Maybe you use no other razor, travel on no other airline. I don't think it has anything to do with the case. To be truthful, rarely a week goes by without something coming in that is occasionally attractive, even amusing. Always lucrative, and the offers are made by well-meaning advertising agencies doing their job. I may be a fond and foolish old Jeffersonian, sharing some of his delusions, not all, I hope, about the goodness of the people, in quotes, but I do believe, I fervently hope anyway, that the mass of people are not fooled. Some months ago I stopped to buy petrol in a one-street town out west. The attendant recognized me, said a few nice things, and in the course of the following chat, he mentioned his surprise in having watched a big football game on the telly at recognizing the voice, not even the sight, mind you, but the voice of an actor of international eminence doing a plug, as we vulgarly say, for some domestic product, shaving cream, camera, I mercifully forget what it was. Well, I said, he was probably paid the earth. The attendant interrupted his wiping of my windscreen. Oh, sure enough, he said, but I've always thought of him as a great actor. And this sort of lets him down, you know what I mean? Lest some of you are sagely nodding your heads, I ought to add that the fees paid for even 1 minute ads by famous people endorsing something that has nothing remotely to do with their talent are huge beyond the imagining of most people. A movie star I once knew who shared my fussiness on this topic suddenly lapsed into a television advertisement for coffee. She was not, by the way, a coffee drinker, but she told me later, a little shamefaced, that she could use the money. Who couldn't have used the $200,000 they paid her for 30 seconds? Of course, if your wife and children are starving, I guess anything goes. I mention this to show people who are beyond such invitations that resistance to this sort of temptation is harder than it sounds at first hearing. And I've noticed that people with no public reputation to endanger are the first to condemn hints of corruption in public men. Not out of superior character, but out of nothing but envy. It comes down in the end, I believe, to every man's, every woman's conscience, which is a flexible organ, and one should not certainly attribute one's own peculiar standards to other people. But I still believe that the Catholic Church was supremely wise in making the number one sin, not greed or sloth or lust, but spiritual pride, feeling that you're better than other people. And so by that test, the condemner could be more of a sinner than the greedy one he condemns. While this row is going on anyway, we might all, in judging the motives of other people, remember the old biblical injunction, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." But, after all, the only conscience you can live with is your own, and if you feel this way, you'd better, for your own comfort, act by it. Comes a point, of course, when a man may be so devoid of conscience that society has to move in and exercise a conscience for him, and that's what is now beginning to happen in the legislative bodies, both of the Congress and the Parliament. The whole thing, for me, was put in a rather high-flown manner, I admit, by George Bernard Shaw, a writer, I'm told by the young, who is now probably at the lowest point of his fame or readability by anybody under 40. Well, in his time, he was thought to be the greatest English-speaking playwright, though today many people may agree with the late James Agot that Mr. Shaw's plays are the price we have to pay for his prefaces. In one of those tremendous prefaces, or rather in a published letter to a friend which preceded the preface to Man and Superman, Shaw ended with, and I quote from memory, this sentence: "The only true joy in life is the being used for a purpose which you recognize to be a mighty one, as the only true tragedy is being used by personally minded rich men for ends that you recognize to be base." Well, apart from the fact that it must be very hard for ditch diggers, coal miners, and the people making biscuits on an assembly line to see themselves as being used for a mighty purpose, the main warning of this great sentence still stands, for my money. Pardon me, for my self-respect.